Thank you very much, Chris. To start, you'll probably notice I stand over here a lot during my my talk. The video camera followed me over, so you know why. I thank the organizers for having invited me, and I'm a bit of an interloper in the sense that I work mainly in random processes and time series analysis, but last time I saw Louisa, I'd mentioned to her that it might be interesting to just review what John Tukey had done in on robustness in time series. As you all know, John worked a great deal in both of those fields. You'll notice, by the way, if you look at your name tag, that Pim stole part of my logo on me. Shame on them. So here's the structure of the talk. I sort of got the talk ready, and then I decided it made more sense to do it from a historical standpoint. So these are the years of key papers that John wrote, and I've been sleeping an hour less each day, I think, for the last years. I've been working on memorial articles about John Tukey and so on. So let me sort of lift a little bit of material from those. So. He was born. He's the prototype New Englander, born in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Brown was he always referred to Brown, where he had been an undergraduate and got a bachelor's and master's in chemistry. But then the rest of his career he spent at Princeton. And when he got the James Madison Medal from Princeton, I guess there were other people who were saying how wonderful it was to be back at Princeton, and John said, well, he'd never left Princeton, indeed. In terms of jobs, during World War II, he worked at the Fire Control Research Office in Princeton, Bell Labs, which is near Princeton and Murray Hill, retired in 85 and died a couple of years ago. He was very, very much honored, and his nephew, another Frank Anscombe, some of you probably knew Frank, has been going through his papers. David Hoagland's the literary executor, and so the nephew was feeding me various letters that he was. And so here's one. So John worked a lot on adjusting the census, and here's a letter from the New York, David Dinkins, saying, "Dear, on behalf of all the residents of the city of New York, substantial number missed by the 19." And thank you. So it's really been quite an exercise. See, letters of thanks from John Kennedy, President Eisenhower, Ford, Nixon, all the various presidents, and so on. So I'm going to throw up a bunch of quotes of John, because I've just sort of gone through the literature so many times. And in terms of robustness and time series, I've tried to select some that are refer to both. Fields. I don't know whether Doug Martin's here. Is Doug here? No, not yet. Like maybe as the only time series analyst here, for research. Challenging combinations of difficulties and forcible attention has done more than any other area to develop my views of data analysts. So you want to learn time series if you want to be working on novel problems in robust resistance. I guess that's I mean, really, it's by merging things that the advances seem to be made now. So this quote here: "Some of us dream of the day when there will again be a standard techniques, this time robust, resistant in character." Just some key things. It's neoclassical. Once robust, resistant, thinking hard whether the answers are seriously different. And then this is a remark from, I think, the mid-80s. Bayesian analysis seems to offer no one real. I'm wondering if there's anybody here I haven't offended yet. we'll see. And some time series things. I've sort of heading towards robust methods. I've yet to meet anyone experiencing analysis of time series who is over-concerned with stationarity. Now, John was renowned for coming up with words, and here is just a selection. This is how many I could fit on the the slide there, and I guess it would be fun to teach a course sometime just going through what all these different words meant and so on. I think actually these I know most of them. Tenting, I'm not sure. You guys probably know what tenting is. Presume it's something like that. Okay, so John Tukey was renowned for work in both robustness and time series, and here are some definitions he had of those two. Resistant procedure, changing a small part of the input, no matter how drastically, changes the output only a little. I'll come back to that. Robust procedure, working well, even rather far from ideal conditions. And I'm going to, because I'm going to be doing this time series stuff, and I want to sort of focus on parallel concepts in both fields, I'm going to be interpreting these definitions rather broadly there. And just to, you know, Tukey's jargon is everywhere, and the time series jargon is everywhere. So here's a few sort of analogies between the two jargons and so on. So when I may just find myself using a time series term without defining it properly. Okay, so the beginning. So Tukey was a chemist, and then he was a topologist, and then in World War II, he got involved in statistics. And everywhere, basically, he refers to Charlie Windsor as the person who got him in doing statistics and got him doing robust statistics. So if you look at the bottom here, when I met Charles P. Windsor in 1941, he had already developed a clear and individual philosophy about the proper treatment of apparent wild shots and so on. And then in terms of the specific problem, he was working on a machine gun firing problem going on with a certain bomber and so on, and was finding that there were outliers involved in the distribution of the shots and so on. And so he was concerned with whether one was better off using the mean absolute deviation or the traditional standard error to the sum, S squared, which was the better. And pretty quickly they found that using the robust method was more to go. So that's sort of the beginnings of robustness, Windsor, and so on. Well, I hadn't realized when I was doing all these various reviews, I was trying to work out just when he really started doing time series analysis. Well, that began in World War II, it turns out. So in a book review, he talks about having read the book that Wiener wrote, the report that Wiener wrote in World War II on time series analysis, really on prediction and forecasting and so on. But then a letter turned up from Norbert Wiener to John, June 20th, 1942. And so it turns out that John was working on estimating the autocorrelation coefficient in a data situation. And the letters from Norbert Wiener talks about John visiting. Well, I have to report that John was wrong in this case. Wiener was right in this particular case, but John was pretty young at that point, and Wiener had been around quite a while already. But anyway, John was doing time series analysis back then, and he also was working on predicting the courses that fire planes follow in order for the guns to be able to shoot at them effectively and so on. So there was a topologist, another topologist, who actually wrote the report, but according to Saunders McLean in an article, John was very much involved in that procedure. There'd been a sort of a two-dimensional analysis of that situation, and so they were concerned with the three-dimensional analysis. Okay, so as I said, I'm going to take follow a historical route here in how I'm going to be talking about these things. So this is sort of where most people view the beginnings of modern analysis as coming from, at least in America, and Bartlett was working on similar problems in the United Kingdom. So this was a Bell Labs memo. I didn't see it until about 15 years ago when the collected works of John Tukey were being produced. And by the way, I mean, you people probably feel it much more than I do, but there was supposed to be a collected works of his robustness papers and so on. And it I don't know what happened. It just never came out. But it's surely nice to have sort of these eight volumes when you're writing review articles, and many of the important papers are there. Anyway, this report, the so-called indirect method of power spectrum estimation, was was introduced and investigated in some real detail by John and his dear friend Dick Hamming. Now, John very rarely put his name first on anything. You just look through the papers he wrote. He's invariably they're in alphabetical order. But this report was in has Hamming's name second. Maybe that's why John never published it. I don't know. Anyway, so one of the things when they were studying the power spectrum was that John developed was that if you took the expected value of the estimate, it was a weighted average against the power spectrum. And if you want to view that's a density function and you've got a kernel estimate, fair enough. Same situation. Okay. Now, the sort of terminology that John used referred to leakage, that you're trying to estimate the spectrum at a frequency lambda, but you end up with this weighted average against the spectrum. And another analogy that I had with that idea was of having a distribution with long tails, and you sort of want these values that are at some distance to not be having too great an effect. He studies the effects of grouping error and discusses reading errors and so on. But one lacking thing was that there was no correction for the mean of the data. So they were basically estimating a second moment. Now, they didn't get any trouble with that in this engineering situation because typically the measurements were fluctuating around zero value, around zero mean level and so on. But you'll see I'm going to focus on that a bit, and he realizes that eventually. Then I talk a bit about, mentioned that this paper also had the idea of aliasing in it. Then we move to 1950. So this really was the first published paper that the people who weren't at the labs had any access to. So there was a symposium on power spectral methods in oceanography, and he gave a paper there. And in terms of adjusting for the mean, when the paper was republished in 56, he added this sentence here, this discussion does not pay sufficient attention to the removal of the mean. A mean differing from zero by an amount which is apparently slight can represent a tremendous high zero frequency peak. So basically it's behaving like an outlier and so on. And then a letter turned up to an oceanographer who'd been at the meeting, Rudnick, in which John wrote, the trouble of adjusting the covariance for the mean is often worthwhile, and it may pay to use different means for different lags if there is an underlying trend. So if you have a linear trend or a quadratic trend or something like that. And back then, the computations were pretty horrific and so on. So when he talks about adjusting the covariances, that was being done in order to reduce the computations. You wouldn't be fitting the values directly to the data, typically. Okay, so moving on to 1956. This is a wonderful paper, actually. This really laid out what was going on in a very understandable way. Spectrum analysis, cross-spectral analysis, and things like that. And I every so often I've met people who were involved with John and the Air Force at that point in time, and they refer to this work. And so actually one of the things that they discovered that's interesting is they had a time series and they were digitizing it to work with, and they were getting the value at discrete time points by taking the average over an interval, going plus or minus around that, instead of actually getting the value right at a particular time point. And that was really making a mess of the estimation procedure. So they had to realize you wanted to record X of T, not a smooth version of X of T. The term pre-whitening very possibly gets introduced here. That's the first reference to it that I know about. Their definition, pre-processing the data to make a spectrum not so violently up and down. You could picture with ordinary random variables, if you transform them to have approximately a uniform distribution. That's a form of pre-whitening. And as I said, I'm focusing on the robustness type thing. So here we say both spikes and rapidly changing general levels in F of lambda cause increased difficulty and warrant considerable effort to improve the spectrum before calculating the mean lag product. So here we're talking about a spike in the frequency domain. So an outlier would be a spike in the time domain in many cases. And so it's sort of interesting. You'll see how John has sort of taken time domain concepts and done them in the frequency domain, or maybe thought of them first in the frequency domain and went back there. And for sure, this is the first sort of published thing beyond that letter where he really is saying you want to be correcting for the mean. okay, a 58 paper. I'm just sort of, there's an immense amount in each of these papers, and I'm really sort of focusing on the things that are nearest to robust resistant methods. So he talks about deletion, removing very sharp peaks in the spectrum. So this is like removing outliers in the in ordinary statistics. But for sure, John knew that removing them didn't mean forgetting them. Basically, the analysis then went down two paths, and you'd find him saying things like, well, this is how you discover things. By the outliers in the frequency domain oftentimes are corresponding to physical phenomena that people knew had no idea were present. Okay, then this is where a lot of people actually learned spectrum analysis from this book. It was two papers that appeared, Bell System Technical Journal, but there was a book published by Dover that came on the scene, and that book plus John's lectures at Princeton were how I learned time series. I work a lot with engineers at Berkeley, and every so often you'll run into one of them, and if they're older, they say, oh, that was just terrible learning about spectrum analysis from this book here. They tried very hard to make it readable to engineers, but I think it's one of these things where you read it, then you reread it, then you reread it, and so on, and eventually you sort of get the thing. Helmholtz's book on measure theory in the preface says something like, you'll find you don't have the prerequisites to read this book until you've read it. Well, this is another example of that type. So you've all been there. I mean, I've heard that about Beethoven. You never want to listen to Beethoven for the first time. Okay, so he has some definitions. Trend, a systematic smooth component of time. Trend removal, rejection near zero frequency. And now it's sort of more explicit. He proposes correcting the second moments by these factors EKR, where this comes from fitting a polynomial trend. So nowadays we would just fit the trend right to the original data and work with the residuals. But in terms of programming, this turned out to be simpler for them. You find in fancy letters in the book this warning: it will almost never be wise to fail to use some EKR in a digital computation. As the mathematician left, I mean, this is the way we statisticians talk all the time, isn't it? No one can ever catch us, but it's sort of interesting seeing it in print there. Talks a lot about residual analysis. Talks about data and frequency windows, which go under the name of taper. So in terms of robust resistance, you could picture you've got a biweight. You've got the weight function going along with a biweight that's sort of near one in the middle, and it comes down smoothly to zero when it gets to the end of the interval over which it's defined. Okay, now we have the course I got to sit in on in Berkeley. Actually, John wrote on the cover of the notes with sympathetic encouragement from David Brillinger. Well, that sort of involved things like he would come by the house at 7 in the morning and ask if I'd take that lecture for him once in a while, but he gave me the lecture notes, so that was that made it a bit easier. A bit easier. Okay, so there are a lot of things in this paper. He introduces the fast Fourier transform. I mean, it turned out that the fast Fourier transform had been known to Gauss and various other people around the turn of the century and things like that. But in terms of where the Cooley-Tukey paper came from, it was really these lecture notes and so on. And I sat there and watched it happen on the blackboard and thought, that's interesting and so on, but then just sort of moved on. I mean, I had no idea that it was going to take off the way it had. It was just seemed like sort of a mathematical artifact. Here's a bit faster way to compute something or the other. Another thing that's in there is smoothing. So smoothing, here we try to retain the smooth portion, which he wonders if it's the same as low-frequency components. So that's things that are moving slowly of the signal, while reducing the more irregular or rapidly variable equals high-frequency components. Now, Stefan's sitting right in the middle here, and I have a feeling he was sort of a bit annoyed that I'd put this paper, not this paper, but I put the smoothing stuff in the time series volume, but at least it got it out. You know, if you had to wait for the robustness to do that, it would be something else. So he's certainly talking about searching for outliers in the frequency domain. studying leakage and so on, the running median gets introduced here, as far as I know. And the repeated running median gets introduced in this paper also. So you can picture having a spectrum with a peak in it. You want to smooth across that to sort of put that peak aside and see what remains below that, and for sure study the peak. And he speculates on having a frequency domain analog of the technique of trimming. He certainly knew all about trimming. He didn't really develop it, but he talks about it, about the possibilities there. Okay, spotty data. So by that he meant in part data with outliers in it. And he refers to Bullard's and Jeffrey's work. So this was really a paper meant for a very broad audience, the people who are working in geophysics. It appeared in Science and so on. So it's written in a very understandable way, really. And he refers to Bullard's talking about the importance of easy and automatic editing of time series for gross errors and omissions. And just in terms of my own work in time series, I mean, for me, outliers, the way I picked them up was I looked at the data. And see, I'd usually typed in the data back at that point, so I just knew I couldn't type straight with probability 1 and so on. So it sort of hadn't yet reached the stage where you had so much data that you couldn't look at it, at least not the data sets I was working on at that point. And he refers to Harold Jeffries also, his attention to relatively precise and efficient ways to analyze observations not normally distributed. So what Jeffries was doing, he was having a model of a Gaussian distribution superposed on top of or mixed in with a uniform distribution over a long interval and so on, and getting maximum likelihood estimates. So the algorithm Jeffries came up with was very much like the Bi-weight algorithm and so on, that you could be fitting that model using iteratively reweighted least squares and so on. So in the paper by Anscombe and Tukey on residuals in technometrics, they refer to Jeffries doing that specifically. Okay, also in this paper he talks about influence. How much will the fit change when the value of any single observation is changed? I don't know when this term entered robust statistics, but there is a 1965 reference to it. Then we move on. See, John's love really was geophysics, seems to me, in terms of using time series technique, oceanography, seismology, those types, so those fields. Here's a paper that was presented at a symposium at IBM. So the collected works do involve quite a few papers that hadn't seen the light of day before. So it's worth looking at them for that. The word patchiness, he uses that there for the first time I know about. And he defines that records consist of quiet periods interrupted by occasional bursts. So that sort of data is very common in geophysics. I mean, in the most extreme case, it'd be you've got seismic noise and then an earthquake happens and so on. And his technique for dealing with that is to be taking some spectra of short stretches of the data. So they could be moving around, and when there's a patch, they'll look different. Okay, now we move on to sort of a major paper at a symposium on spectrum analysis. There had been a symposium at Brown in like 1962 where the idea of Kestrel analysis was introduced and so on. So then there was one at Madison in 68 that a lot of major papers appeared in. So he talks about cross-spectrum analysis. Now, when I'm teaching time series, I'll be teaching the students how useful the parameter of coherence is for studying time series. That's the relations. That's the frequency domain analog of the coefficient of determination or squared coefficient of correlation. And I'll tell them, they'll sort of be impressed in how this is a measure of linear time invariant relationship and so on. And, you know, so everything's going along quite smoothly until I tell them, but when you've got real data, you can find yourself with a coherence basically zero, even though there's a perfect linear time invariant relationship between the two series, or you can find yourself with a coherence basically one when there's no relationship between the series. So this is sort of one of the ways that time series is a lot of fun. It's sort of like when you teach confidence intervals, so the students will look confused, then you'll keep talking about it, and then they'll start to look like they understand it. And I'm always tempted to say, no, you don't understand it yet. You still don't understand it. There's some more learning to go on. Anyway, so that's he is sort of referring to that in this quote. And then he has this remark, it seems likely that the use of trim means, trim sums of squares, and trim sums of square differences will prove useful. Talks about echoes a bit, and an echo is like a situation where there are two outliers that are present in the data. Okay, now we get to the smoothing paper, and this was a paper given at an engineering conference. He has definitions of resistance and robustness in there for the engineers, and he has this decomposition of you're taking the input and you're breaking it into a smooth part and a rough part. I'm going to come back to that in a bit. He does this elementary algebra here. This smoothing technique gets introduced, and he refers to end effects. And that's, again, going back to things like the biweight, where you want to pull the weight function to be down towards zero in a smooth fashion. Okay. This is now a paper at a symposium concerned with neurophysiology, electroencephalogram analysis. The idea of white top spectra get introduced, that you don't want to pre-whiten so that you just are finding yourself with a measurement noise. You want to leave some sort of structure there. About robust resistance, he says, today we have techniques with properties so desirable as to be thought impossible only a few years ago. So this is 78, he's saying that. Talks about using them to fix baseline values, the zero level. Okay, so this is something he talks about specifically, that it's sort of, for time series now, seeking to do robust resistant methods. So suppose you have a situation where, say, you're flashing a light in someone's eyes, or you're making a sound, and so on, and you're recording the brain waves. Well, in many cases, you'll see a response immediately. That's called an evoke response. And then you repeat that experiment a number of times. Sometimes you have to repeat it 2,000 times before you actually are seeing, when you average the responses, you're actually seeing the signal. Anyway, because it's people and because the EEG leads are just sort of, they're not permanently fixed to the brain and so on, there are a lot of evoke responses that aren't that aren't really of the same, measuring the same thing, let me put it that way. So he proposes that you measure the exoticity of the J-th response by this sum of deviations from it's going to be from sort of the estimate of the evoked response, average evoked response, at the previous time point. So he's setting up an iterative procedure here, like a biweight and so on, measuring the deviation from the best estimate you have at a particular point. There are lots of Argentinians here, so I thought I'd mention that I'll call him Manolo, because he went to Brazil. Fueiro did. And somewhere I have a picture of that. So this is actually, this was data for the Amazon River, the height of the Amazon. And there's a definite annual seasonal effect present. Like day 200, you see the rivers, it's the stage values at the very high value. And so in an analysis I was doing, I thought, well, why don't we seasonally adjust the data by taking out the 50% trim mean? So I used Folieto's program to be estimating the seasonal effect. So this is actually the mean of the 50% middle values, measuring the deviation by that measure John talked about. And then here are the different deviations. And so you see this value here, for example. So that was a year there were a lot of fires in the Amazon, and the water flow was unusual. Okay, so so I've been sort of showing hints of John doing robust resistant statistics with time series, but you know, he sort of is more referred to one could and things like that. Then in the next period, he started referring very strongly to this collection of papers here. He wasn't really proposing this, but he was talking about Thompson. He referred often to this paper of Thompson's, where he'd found that a pair of outliers could really destroy the spectrum estimate, and if you tapered, you could reduce the effect of that. He talked about fitting autoregressives to the data in a robust way, and that's the sort of things that was going on in the Kleiner and Doug Martin and Thompson research. So it was sort of like he switched to viewing these people as sort of Well, I don't know. He was sort of watching what these people were doing and encouraging them and so on, I would say. But John really bursts on the scene doing robust resistance in this paper. There was a time series symposium in 1980 in Iowa, Iowa State, and he really lets it rip. So he talks about tapering with a data window being essential, introduce a new word, pawing, which is you're going to pad the data by adding zeros to be able to use fast Fourier transform, and windowing, the importance of a window. And he talks about the character of the data might be Gaussian with stretched tails going along with it. His time outliers, so that's the sort I was making when I was typing in the data. But now he really focuses on frequency outliers. He talks about time outliers, where you may have two of them, and how that affects the estimated spectrum. He talks about frequency echoes being present and the effect that has. In terms of treating outliers, he says you want to shrink them, possibly towards zero, or maybe you're going to use a robust resistant interpolated value here. Now, my take on this situation is his work in robust resistance with ordinary statistical data, real value data, let's say, and also bivariate, multivariate to an extent, was now sort of feeding its way back into his work on time series analysis. Talks about a second kind of aliasing, so that's sort of things time series guys would worry about. Talks about dominant time behavior, dominant frequency behavior. See, he always wanted to be in the frequency domain, but he for sure knew that if something was going weird was going on in the time domain, that could cause trouble. He talks about separating everything to be plotted in a robust, resistant way into a rough and a smooth, satisfying this identity here. So I'm going to have an example of that in just a moment. So he's throwing out all these ideas. So there are a lot of ideas that wait for us to develop in less time series or resistance guys to develop in some sort of detail. Talks about oddities in the data, outliers in time or frequency, narrow peaks in time or frequency, bulges in time or frequency, echoes, amplitude modulation, things of that sort. And in terms of long-tailed distributions, could have outliers scattered in time. I'll call them outliers. They might be scattered in frequency. And there might be over a domain of values, a patch of values. So the stretching refers to wherever, the stretching, the long-tailed distributions. Okay, so John and I wrote a paper together, lots of phone calls from all over the place. I learned it was better to be upstairs on a bed with a pad when I was talking to John. Some others of you have probably had that sort of situation. Now, just in terms of that paper, now, so we sort of had a layout and so on, and I was asking John, well, don't you want to have some robust resistant material in this paper? And he agreed he did, but what he wrote was sort of dated. It's sort of like he'd forgotten all these neat ideas from the 1980 paper, and I mean, he talked about the biweight and so on. And I wish I'd sort of known enough to press him a bit more about why aren't you including some of those values. Now, the Tukey students here, probably Stefan and so on, Stefan Morgenthaler knows about getting phone calls from John Tukey, and you know, he had some idea, and so he called me 30 April 1984. I always kept these pieces of paper because they were sort of golden. And he said, well, suppose you want to have some pictures when you're doing spectrum estimation. What about getting influence curves for autoregressive estimates? So in terms of his definition of influence, where you change a value and you see how much the resulting estimate changes, I'm going to show an example in just a moment. My example is going to be for using the Kleiner-Martin and Thompson estimate. And he talked about having plots of what he called the input and the smooth and the plus. So I'm going to be showing those. So in terms of pictures you guys will know well, this is from Moss, Deller, and Tukey, where he's getting influence curves with his definition for the mean. So his definition was you're going to change any single value by an arbitrary large amount. You're going to let it go from minus infinity to plus infinity, and then you're going to see what happens to the statistics. So for the mean, it's just growing linearly, because the mean is a linear function. For the median, it's behaving like so. And for the biweight, it's behaving in this fashion here. So I did that for some time series data. I took the Lynx data because I knew I was talking in Canada. So these are data on the Canadian Lynx collected by the Hudson Bay Company. Hudson Bay Company still exists. It's in downtown Vancouver, but it's called The Bay now. So what I did was I took that data and I modified the 25th observation. I let it go from minus infinity to infinity. And so that's this plot here. So this is sort of meant to be his influence function. So this is frequency going down here. And then this is how much I'm modifying it by. So the estimate where I didn't change the value at all is right in the middle here. And you sort of see that the low frequencies down here, the thing is sort of staying the same shape. But as you sort of go to the higher frequencies, it's having a big effect. If Doug was here, he could be pleased to see that this was the robust estimate, which has really sort of gone right to the heart of the matter. So basically, the thing in the middle is sort of expressing itself. Here is the estimate when I added 3 to it. So this is basically this is the spectrum estimate where you've added 3 to one of the observations. This is the Kleiner et al. Estimate. So you sort of see how it's headed down here. So the effect of this outlier has been to lift up the high frequencies and make it harder to see the peaks. And so John wanted to have the input plotted, the smooth plotted, and the rough plotted. So here we are. So this is basically, this on a log scale, this is the difference between those. So you sort of see this is the rough part of the estimate, which one needs to think about and understand. You can do, in S plus, they give you sort of the makings of what you need to do this. So this is what the input was. So here's the estimate. I've added 3 onto it, onto the actual series. This is what S plus gives you for now, the estimate of the smooth. So it's just taking that out. And then when you look at the difference between the input and the smooth, you see the outlier just sort of zaps out. So that technique really seems to be working pretty well. Okay, so Stefan, I got told I could go till 2:15 just because we started late. So don't think I'm trying to get at you to get you more nervous about the soccer game on Wednesday or anything like that. Okay, so John Tukey was an outlier detector. Frank Koppel has this wonderful story that during the robustness year at Princeton, there was printout. Back those days, you had these big stacks of printout. And there were several thousand numbers, and somehow John Tukey found an outlier among them. When you watched him, he's taking differences and smoothing things and things like that. And it turned out to be a typing error. Okay, so what's he advocating? Well, rebuilding procedures to make them robust resistant. So I think, you know, now is the time in statistics. We want to be doing a lot more of this, merging robust methods with time series, robust methods with multivariate. I know a number of people are doing that here. Merging robust methods with statistical computing and so on. Basically, young people want to sort of be in both of two fields at the same time. Something that would be a more direct extension would be getting procedures for point processes, marked point processes, spatial data, and so on. That has gone on that's sort of a more natural thing to do. I feel the feeling to sort of sit down and do it. But when you want to, if you're led to do it with some real data, then there are going to be some surprises, and that's exactly what John is saying here. We cannot believe that we have yet imagined all the oddities that real data sometimes shows. Thank you very much, everybody.